to another top-rated show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
All right, welcome everybody. I am Tom Garcia, and this is the USA Talk Radio Network and the American Hour. Thank you for joining me. Got a lot of stuff to talk about. It looks like, I'll get back to some administrative stuff in a second, but it looks like the Republicans have done just what I predicted at the beginning of the week. Speaker Boehner has gotten a bill passed that's going to extend the government, pain for the government by a week, and I don't know the details. I was saying at the beginning of the week it's probably going to cut some money, and it's going to fully fund the military to the end of the year, because there's nothing the Democrats would love to have more than the military as hostages. Now, don't get me wrong, the military will continue to operate whether they're funded or not. It's just a matter of our poor soldiers and sailors not getting paid, and I got to experience this firsthand in 84 when Reagan vetoed the Democrats' budget bill for the next year, and it just happened to be transitioning from September to October, and the government shut down for just a little bit, but it stopped my paycheck, so it was, I don't remember at this point, it was so long ago, I was like 23 at the time, I didn't get a paycheck for either 2 weeks or 4 weeks, whatever it was. It wasn't pleasant, so I'm glad that they have done that. I'm not for another continuing resolution, but I think the purpose for this was to ensure that our military service members were going to get aid for the rest of the year. Okay, so that said, I'm reading in the news that Obama's saying he's going to veto it. And so what's he, if he says he's going to veto it and the Democrats pass it, I mean, they're between a rock and a hard place. If the Democrats in the Senate don't even look at it, which they'll have to, and they don't pass it, then they're the bad guys. If they do pass it and then he vetoes it, I don't know what that makes him look like, but I think it looks like he's going to throw them under the bus. You know, he's tried to stay aloof of this whole thing rather than exercise leadership, and that's been pretty clear to me throughout this whole process. So he must have something he thinks up his sleeve that is going to make the Republicans look bad, even at the expense of the Democrats. So that's the latest in the news. Let's talk about what's coming up here. Tomorrow's a big day. Franz Cabreau, most influential conservative in Florida. You don't want to miss the show. If you're from Florida, you probably already know who he is. If you're not from Florida, you want to come and see this show. Let me give you a quick little taste of what the show's going to be like. First of all, he recently came out with a book called Stolen History. And on the book cover, it simply says this: revealing the truth to unite America. We won't recognize true freedom until we know our true history. And you can go to his website if you're interested in finding out more about him. It's FranzCabreau.com, and here's how you spell it. His first name is Franz, F-R-A-N-T-Z, last name Cabreau, K-E-B-R-E-A-U. That's Franz Cabreau, so just go to FranzCabreau.com, and you can find out more about him. But his book is really about the stolen history of blacks in America and what the left would like you to believe actually occurred during the civil rights movement and much, much further back. He goes back into the early 1800s. Fantastic presentation. You'll see nothing but glowing reviews of the presentations that he gives. But here's what he says on his website. This book will arm you with the knowledge to combat the progressives and their socialist agenda. The progressives control our education system, and they have for nearly 100 years. They pick and choose what is important and what is not. They are rewriting history as we speak, and it has become my job to expose it. So, great book, great reviews, great speaker, and you're going to enjoy listening to what he has to say tomorrow. We'll talk about a variety of things, not just his book and his speaking, but a few other interesting topics as well. Okay, that's for tomorrow. Coming up, what else we have? Big show on Monday. Paul Skousen. You don't want to miss that one. If you're familiar with the book, The 5,000-Year Leap, and that reminds me, I was supposed to give one of those books away. Well, on Monday, I'll be giving a couple of those books away, so don't miss the show. If you call in, you have a chance to win one of the 5,000-Year Leap books that I have, and that's written by his father, Cleon Skousen. Paul worked in the CIA and was also in the Reagan administration and even helped get shredded secret documents of Ollie North out of the White House. So he's got an interesting background. But on the 4th, I was going to give away a copy of the 5,000-Year Leap to the people who have joined the American Hour radio show page on Facebook. I've been so busy last week and traveling that I didn't get around to blasting that out, so I thought today I would make the announcement. So hopefully you're listening out there, the winner. If not, you're still going to get a message from me via Facebook. Teresa Acosta. Teresa Acosta, I don't know where you're from. Don't know that much about you. I looked on Facebook real quickly just to see if there's any information. Just know that you're on Facebook. But Teresa Acosta, a friend of the show, the American Hour radio show, is the winner of the 5,000-Year Leap plus 12 pocket constitutions to go to her friends and neighbors. So that takes care of that. Let's see. What else do we have coming up? Some other good shows. Kelly Townsend of the Greater Phoenix Tea Party Group. She'll be on Tuesday the 12th. And Mark Ross, I told you about Mark. He's a fantastic writer and got some great ideas on the Constitution, our government, and on conservatism. And he wrote an article recently called What is Conservatism? Nick Taxiro, he'll be on the 18th of April. And he's got a very interesting website. It makes me laugh every time I go there, called DaProgressive. DaProgressive.org is where you need to go. Then on the 22nd of April, we've got Winston Scott, former astronaut, and we'll be talking about mostly NASA for that show. Any of you on the Space Coast in Central Florida, I know you'll be interested in that, but anybody in the country, he's got some great insight into where NASA is now, where it's headed, and where it ought to be headed, so don't miss that. All right, that's for upcoming shows. Again, tomorrow, Franz Cabreau, 4 o'clock Eastern, don't miss that. Now, what are we going to talk about today? We've got a lot of things to talk about today. I'm going to start off with something. Oh, I don't know if I'll call it on the lighter side, but something that I got from a friend of mine. John White emailed this out, and it's a copy of a column written by Charlie Reese. He's a former Orlando Sentinel columnist. If you want to find Charlie, I found him by Googling and found out that he's working with the Florida Whig Party. Don't know much about that group. Obviously, I don't know anything about him. I'm not going to say anything about him, but it's a really good article, and it's really not a partisan article at all. It's really pointing the finger at our representatives and our politicians. So the title of the article is 545 versus 300 million people. And again, this is by Charlie Reese, former Orlando Sentinel columnist. So let's just get right into the article. And he brings up some interesting sort of almost questions, rhetorical questions, but they get you thinking about what's really going on in our country right now. He starts off by saying, politicians are the only people in the world who create problems and then campaign against them. Boy, isn't that true? Have you ever wondered if both Republicans are against deficits? Why do we have deficits? Well, we can see that playing out right today before our very eyes. Not against deficits. In fact, they're addicted. They can't stop spending. They just can't cut the size of the... In fact, what the news was talking about earlier today and night is that the Democrats are willing to cut $33 billion from the budget, the current budget, before the end of the year, which amounts to about, I think, something like 5 days of, maybe it's only 3 days of interest payments on our debt. Wow. Boy, that's just so significant. That's really working for the people, isn't it? Of course, the Republicans aren't a whole lot better. They want, I think, $7 million more than that. So we're talking about $44 billion, whatever the number is. They're a little bit better, and they just can't seem to come together. They just can't seem to come together. We're going to get into this a little bit later, but I keep seeing this on the news as well, and I'm hearing people talk about it. They're just tired of the partisan politics. Well, we're going to talk about partisan politics here in a little bit later on. Partisan politics. If you're tired of it, if you are, say, 240 years old, you'd be really tired of it because we've had it from almost the beginning. And we'll get back to that later. But anyway, partisan politics, and we just can't solve this budget problem because we just can't stop spending. Now, what the Democrats, I guess, have proposed to the Republicans is, look, if you'll meet us on the $33 billion, we'll then allow you to cut from mandatory spending. Now, we've talked about this on the show before. and I believe I talked about it yesterday. There's a difference between mandatory and discretionary and, of course, non-mandatory spending. There is all kinds of non-mandatory military and even social services, like Social Security and Medicare spending. A big part of that, though, is national security and the military. Non-mandatory. What does that equate to? In my book, pork. But here's what the Democrats have proposed to the Republicans. Not let's cut non-mandatory defense spending, and I guarantee you there's a lot of pork and waste in there. And you've heard me say it before, and you're getting tired of hearing it. I've written op-eds on exactly these kinds of waste because I know where they are, and I've been justified in the past because eventually those programs are cut programs that I've said are wasteful spending. But the Democrats didn't say, let's cut some of the pork. They said, let's cut some of the mandatory defense spending. Now, I realize there's going to be some pork there, too. And when I say pork, actually, it's waste. It's not so much pork, but it's waste. There's plenty of waste there. But why would they go after the mandatory spending versus the non-mandatory? So Republicans, boy, if you want to join sides with the Democrats, they'll allow you on down the road to cut some of our mandatory defense spending. But they won't allow you to touch the government. Oh, no. No cuts to the actual federal government. No, we don't want to cut that in size. We'll see if we can make it more efficient. And if you want to know precisely what kind of efficiencies they're talking about, go take a look at that deficit commission that the president put together. And they talk about, you know, using less ink and less paper and paper clips and on, trying to be more efficient. Wow. But nowhere does it talk about cutting the size of the government. Wow. That's just, I don't know. The only word that comes to mind every time I think about this stuff is disgraceful. So in any case, we see this going on right in front of us. Democrats and Republicans are all against deficits, but we have them. Even the Republicans, which have proposed for next year's budget to cut spending by $6 trillion over 10 years. Remember, we talked about this yesterday. It's spending. It's not the debt. We'll still be going into debt. We'll just be going into debt a little bit slower. Wow. Okay. Back on to Charlie Reese's article here. Have you ever wondered if all politicians are against inflation and high taxes? Why do we have inflation and high taxes? Let's see. I'm going to jump down here and get to a few more of these. Here we go. 100 senators, 435 congressmen, one president, and 9 Supreme Court justices equate to 545 human beings out of the 300 million are directly, legally, morally, and individually responsible for the domestic problems that plague our country. So that's why he entitled this, 540 versus 300 million. They're responsible, not us. They're responsible. I guess you could say we're responsible for electing them, and this is where he gets the cuts to the chase of his article. He said, it seems inconceivable to me, that a nation of 300 million cannot replace 545 people who stand convicted by present facts of incompetence and irresponsibility. I can't think of a single domestic problem that is not traceable directly to those 545 people. When you fully grasp the plain truth that 545 people exercise the power of the federal government, then it must follow that what exists is what they want to exist. I couldn't agree more. All right, so there's more of the article. If you want to check out that article, go Google Charlie Reese, spelled R-E-E-S-E, 540 versus 300 million people. And that's really kind of what we're up against. Now, he threw the Supreme Court in there, and unfortunately, we can't unelect them. We can't get rid of them, and that's become a big problem. And we all know that. So we're going to delve a little bit into the problem of the Supreme Court. And there's an article that was in the USA Today just a couple days ago that talked about a ruling that the Supreme Court upheld for Arizona. And we're going to talk about that because it's going to lead us into the history of the Supreme Court and decisions affecting our nation and us as people and the states. All right. So let's see. Where did I put that paper? Here it is today. It's USA Today for Tuesday, April 5th. And the article, I'm just going to get right to the heart of it, said courts okay tax breaks for private schools. The Arizona law gives tax credits up to $500 to individuals and $1,000 to married couples for donations to school tuition organizations. Now, those groups then provide scholarships to students for private schools, including religious ones. Oh, no, religious ones. Boy, separation of church and state, we just can't allow that. That's just terrible. Well, throughout this article, and the reason I brought this article up is because I got some phone calls and some emails about it. They say, Tom, the article keeps referring to the government is not allowed to create any laws respecting the establishment of religion. It keeps you, the whole article uses the word government, government, government. In fact, let's take a look at a quote from Stephen Shapiro, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, which represents the challengers. And he says, the decision undermines the role of the courts in preserving the core constitutional principle that government may not subsidize religion. Okay, government may not subsidize religion. Let me even read what Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority, wrote for the majority. He said, the Arizonans that challenged the program lacked sufficient grounds to bring the lawsuit. He said, taxpayers may sue based on the constitutional guarantee that government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Now, he says government. Throughout the article is government. Tom, the Constitution doesn't say government. It says Congress. And you've got it absolutely right. The Constitution says that the Congress can make no law respecting the establishment of religion. So how is it that we can apply that to the states? Well, that's a great question, because it can be applied to the states because of our judicial activism. See, the intent of that clause in the Constitution was not to make sure that governments could not make any laws respecting the establishment of religion. And in fact, it was meant to protect it, because several of the states did have religions that were state religions or made laws that respected that. So that clause was actually to protect the states. What it did was it said that Congress can't meddle in what the states are doing when it comes to respecting religion. That was the purpose of it. So there's the intent. So how did we end up with Supreme Court justices that now use the term government and not Congress and apply it to the states? Well, it's all because of the 16th Amendment and the incorporation of the Bill of Rights, which came along. I'm sorry, I said the 16th. It's the 14th Amendment. Prior to the ratification of the 14th Amendment and the development of the incorporation doctrine, the federal government held that the Bill of Rights applied to the federal but not the state governments. Now, what does the 14th Amendment say? We're familiar with the part that says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. And that was because of the Dred Scott ruling. In fact, this whole section is because of the Dred Scott ruling, where our activist Supreme Court judges ruled that blacks were never intended to have citizenship, therefore they can't have. So how do you get around a Supreme Court that rules like that? Well, you write an amendment to the Constitution. This whole amendment, this whole section was designed to ensure that the former slaves and their children would have citizenship. Here's where it goes on. No state shall make or enforce law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Okay, so they were concerned that, hey, if the Supreme Court could do this, maybe state courts and state legislatures would try and do the same thing. So that's why they wrote this. But what has happened in modern times? Well, in modern times, our federal courts and Supreme Court have ruled that the 14th Amendment means that the rules and regulations concerning, say, the establishment of religion or rules concerning religion also applies to the states. So what they call that is an incorporation of rights against the states, incorporation against the states. Okay, so they're taking a variety, Second Amendment, First Amendment, these now apply to states, to state governments, because of Supreme Court's ruling that the 14th Amendment means we can now apply federal statutes to the states, and that was never the intention. So we amended the Constitution for one purpose and got a whole nother purpose. Now, let me read to you from Article 4 of the Constitution. Article 3. Article 3 of the Constitution, it talks about the judicial power of the United States. And the first section talks about who the Supreme Court really is. Section 2 is really the only section that tells us what their authority is. It says that power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made. That's it. That is it. So we've got a very ambiguous direction for the Supreme Court to go, and what have they done with it? They've taken and run with it. Now I'm going to refer to one of my favorite books on the subject, written by Henry Adams. It's The History of the United States, 1801 to 1809. If you want to run out and get it at Amazon, you may want to think twice. It's over 1,200 pages long. It's really very historical, also very political, and we're going to come back to it for another subject in a little bit. But see how we're doing on time, and maybe we want to take a break here. Yeah, we'll go another 5 minutes, and then we'll take a break. And if you want to call in, the phone number is 310-982-4145. That's 310-982-4145. All right. So taking a look at Henry Adams' book on the history of the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, after a particular ruling by the Supreme Court, wasn't too happy, and here's what he said. He said the nation declared its will, he said, by dismissing functionaries of one principle and electing those of another, and the two branches, executive and legislative, submitted to their election. But, he goes on, over the judiciary department, the Constitution has deprived them of control. So here's one of the times where Thomas Jefferson calls out the Constitution for not being done right. Well, Henry Adams lays out a pretty good case for the fact that if anybody could have made some changes, amended the Constitution, and gotten the support of the federal government, it was Thomas Jefferson at the time. Now, there are some reasons he did it, and I agree with Henry Adams as to those reasons. I think there are some other reasons as well, some ideas that I have. But it would have been tough, and there were other things that he was focused on. He knew that he could control and keep under tabs issues facing the judiciary, so he wasn't too concerned about it. And I guess he felt that role model that he would set in his administrations, and then, of course, James Madison took over after him, that would set some precedent that on down the road we wouldn't have to worry about it. But 22 years later, he admitted to some degree that he was wrong, and we'll get to that part where he suggests what we should actually do. But continues on talking about how this is harmful to the people, and this was a failing of the Constitution. Well, 4 years before his death, he talked about this again, and to some degree he confessed that maybe he was wrong, that it wasn't a fault of the Constitution. It's just that something could have been done. But here's what he said. Before the canker is become inveterate, before its venom has reached so much of the body politic as to get beyond control, remedy should be applied. Let the future appointments of judges be 4 or 6 years and renewable by the president and the Senate. Wow, term limits for the judiciary. And that came from Thomas Jefferson, our third president of the United States of America. Not much has changed, has it? Boy, we need term limits for everybody in Congress, the Senate, and the judiciary. So he was absolutely right. So why didn't he do something? In 1801, he probably could have. I'm not going to get into that. If you want to go look it up on the internet or go get the book, go to your library. You can find it there. Again, it's Henry Adams, History of the United States, 1801 to 1809. Here's what happened. The judges held office for life, and the Constitution would require an amendment of 2/3 of the Senate and 3/4 of the states. Jefferson just didn't want to get into that because he thought it could cause Connecticut, possibly Massachusetts, to secede. We had states that were just looking for an excuse to do that, and it was a fragile union still, so that's a big part of the reason he didn't want to do it. But let's take a look at the Judiciary Act of 1789. This is what Henry Adams calls the triumph of the Federalist centralization. It had conferred on the Supreme Court jurisdiction over the final judgment of state courts in cases where the powers of the general government had been drawn in question. In other words, the states said, we don't think that the federal government's doing the right thing, so we're going to make our own ruling on that. And that was allowed back then, up until the Judiciary Act. This concession of power to the Supreme Court, a concession often alleged to be more dangerous to the states than the necessary and proper clause itself, was believed to be dictated by a wish to make the state judiciaries inferior courts of the central government. because the powers of the general government might be drawn in question in many ways on many occasions, and thus the authority of the state courts made contemptible. All right, so that was the bottom line, taking away sovereignty from the states. And this is, of course, how Jefferson won. He won on state rights. So again, if somebody was going to make a change to the way the judiciary operated back then and amend the Constitution to clarify the role of the Supreme Court, it would have been Jefferson. He won overwhelmingly on states' rights. This would have been the time to do it. But, alas, we did not do it. And then he continues on. Such a result would hardly have happened had the Republicans in 1801 revised the laws which they considered unconstitutional. But unfortunately, a ruling against a Virginia court stood for about 16 years, and even when Madison was president, by then, for Virginia to assert the unconstitutionality of the law, the Judiciary Act, was not going to hold water because they had lived with it for 16 years. So there were a lot of problems about doing it on down the road. But I think we can see over the course of the history of our country the continuing damage on and on and on from the ability of a lifetime activist Supreme Court and what they can do. And you have no better instance to look at than the Dred Scott. Look up Dred Scott on the internet, the Dred Scott Supreme Court ruling, and you'll see just what a Supreme Court can actually do to its country. So that's a little history on the Supreme Court and how we've gotten to the point where the Constitution has basically been rewritten. It's no longer just the federal government that cannot make any rules or regulations concerning the establishment of religion. And I'll read it to you straight out of the Constitution. You find the amendments to the Bill of Rights. Here we go. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Okay, there you have it. Congress. It doesn't say anybody or anything else, and that was the intent. But we've traded that for what we've used the 14th Amendment, which again was not intended for anything other than what it did at the time. So I am really a proponent of amending the Constitution to clarify what the judiciary can do and the state right and the rights of states. It's going to be hard to do. Probably will never happen. But the bottom line is this. We're going to continue to see these kinds of problems crop up. Thank goodness we have a conservative Supreme Court right now that ruled the way it did in Arizona. But if we had had a liberal court, which is another reason to get rid of this president we have, he will very likely have an opportunity to appoint another judge if he gets another 4 years, and in which case it will be a liberal court. And we will see all kinds of rulings that go against the favor of the citizens and the states because they will favor the government, the federal government. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about, are you tired of partisan politics? Again, if you want to call in, please do. The number is 318-2-4145. I'd like to sum it. Are you tired of partisan politics? All right, we'll be right back. National Veterans Homeless Support, or NVHS, was formed by veterans for the sole purpose of locating and assisting the more than 4,500 homeless veterans living in the parks, forests, and streets of Central Florida. Their mission is clearly defined: to eliminate homelessness among veterans in Central Florida, and they work very hard to accomplish this mission. They offer a very unique service to the community in that they are the only organization that goes out into the field searching for the veterans, providing supplies where they find them, and working with other organizations to get them out of the woods and back into society. If you go to their website, it's located at nvhs.us, and you can also find them on Facebook. Their Veterans Resources link on their webpage is worth its weight in gold, so please go check out the website, and if you're able, make a donation. They do a very, very valuable service to the veterans of Central Florida, and we'd like to expand this and see it expand to the rest of the country.
You're listening to another top-rated show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia.
All right, we're back. Let's talk about partisan politics. People say that they're tired of partisan politics. Well, you know, I just referenced the book, The History of the United States, 1801-09, by Henry Adams. One of the things that opened my eyes when I read that book was that not much has changed in politics. In fact, I think the partisan politics and the mudslinging was worse back then. So when George Washington was president, not so much. We had sort of a neutral government. Washington became more of a Federalist as time went on, but there really wasn't much partisanship. When John Adams became president, that's when it started to grow. He clearly wanted a bigger role for government, and the reason we have our circuit courts is when Adams lost the race to Jefferson and the Congress became a significant majority of Republicans and the Senate a slim majority of Republicans, what did they do? They created the circuit court system that put federal judges in every state to oversee and monitor and manage the state courts. And so, as Henry Adams puts it, as they lost power, as the Federalists lost power, they inserted themselves into the judiciary and used that as their power base. And in fact, none of the appointments made under John Adams to the federal circuit courts were Republicans. They were all Federalists. But the partisanship and the mudslinging, I mean, some of the candidates and even elected officials, they would write what would equate to an op-ed today for a paper that favored their point of view or their party, and it would get published. Everybody would know who wrote it, but they wouldn't use their name. They would use a pen name. So everybody would pretty much know, and you can always tell the writing style, and they would really call out their opponents and other people. I mean, it could get pretty ugly sometimes. And Jefferson had an ongoing sort of fight with the clergy, especially in the Northeast, and they, you know, wrote some things that weren't so quite so nice to him, and he wrote some things that weren't so nice of them. In any case, partisanship goes back a long, long time. So I think people say they get tired of the partisanship and the bickering and the mudslinging and the name-calling, but everybody's doing it. I don't think it's going to go away. I'd like to see it go away, but guess what? I really don't think it's going to go away, and therefore just going to have to live with it. But what you need to do, what I need to do, what we all need to do is cut through that, parse through the partisan politics, and look for the truth yourself. Look for the truth yourself and ignore the partisanship, because it's going to be there and there's no way to get around it. All right, let's move on and go to another article that caught my eye, and this is not something really new, but it's something that's near and dear to me, and that is the whole concept of climate change. We've got a lot of people that truly, truly believe in it, and then we've got a lot of people that think it's all a hoax. I'm on the side of it's a bunch of baloney. And the way I look at it is a very simple approach to looking at climate change. In the last 1 million years, and this is using the exact kind of science that the climate alarmists use, and that is ice core samples from Antarctica, the things that they use to try and prove that CO2 is destroying our planet. We have had 8 ice ages in 1 million years. Now, how old is this planet? Like 500 million years old? In just 1 million years, 8 ice ages. 8. Now, the reason I decided to look at this was originally that first Ice Age animated movie. I thought, yeah, how many, you know, when have they occurred and how long have they lasted and all that kind of stuff. 8 in the last 1 million years. They come with very regular frequency. And up to now, the longest any one of those ice ages has lasted is 20,000 years. How far are we, not the ice age, but the warming period. The ice ages themselves last longer than the warming periods. They can last up to 80,000 years, 80,000 to 100,000 years. So I was curious to find out, and I saw that we currently are in a warming period that's already been from the time the Ice Age ended and started warming, and that can take a 1,000 or 2,000 years. We've been into this current warming period 18,000 years, and we've had warming periods in the past that only lasted a few thousand years. Overall, in the last 1 million years, our planet has been a very cold planet. And then the final thing I'll say is that those ice core samples show that every time temperature is up, CO2 is up. And that's what they want you to believe, is that too much CO2 in the air is causing the temperature to go up. The problem is temperature always preceded CO2. So what are we talking about here? Lots of carbon dioxide in the air doesn't cause the temperature to go up. The temperature going up makes the planet a more tropical planet. We have lots of more people and animals and plants. That's why CO2 goes up. And we're talking about times when man didn't even exist. So it's all a bunch of baloney. But let's see what this article by James Dellingpole. His last name is Dellingpole. And I got this off of The Telegraph, a UK newspaper. James Dellingpole. And the name of it is Climate Change, the New Eugenics. Now, if you're not familiar with eugenics is a process of getting rid of people. not just killing them, but by scientifically altering how people reproduce or causing them to not be able to reproduce. And here is kind of one of the fathers of eugenics, and this is based on an article that Neil Ferguson wrote that James Dellingpole references, but Francis Galton. And here's what he said about Francis Galton, who was involved with the Germans in the early 1900s. He said, the important point to note is that 100 years ago, work like Galton's was at the cutting edge of scientific research. Racism wasn't some backward-looking reactionary ideology. It was state-of-the-art, and people then believed in it as readily as people today buy into the theory of man-made climate change. All right, so let's get into the meat of this. Here's somebody who's taken it to a modern step, and that would be the book by Harrison Brown called The Challenge of Man's Future, 1954. So let's see what he had to say in furthering eugenics, not so much for race, but for making us a better, more healthy people is what he would call it. He said, thus we could sterilize or in other ways discourage the mating of the feeble-minded. We could go further and systematically attempt to prune from society by prohibiting them from breeding, persons suffering from serious inheritance forms of physical defects such as congenital deafness, dumbness, blindness, or absence of limbs. Aha. Those are the kind of people we should sterilize. Yeah, that's nice. Okay. So if you're on board with me, what eugenics is, it's a way of weeding out what is perceived to be the weak. It could be either by race or by physical condition, etc. So now let's move into the future. Why am I talking about all of this? Well, because we have a gentleman who you may recognize the name, John Holdren, big, big admirer of Harrison Brown and his eugenics. And who is John Holdren? Well, he's a green activist who now happens to be President Obama's director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, a.k.a. Science Czar. Aha, this is a guy who's in charge of science, who admired Mr. Brown. Well, let's just see what he has to say himself about this kind of stuff. In 1986, Holdren edited and co-wrote a homage entitled Earth and the Human Future. So it was a homage to the challenge of man's future. And here's what he had to say. 30 years after Harrison Brown elaborated these positions, it remains difficult to improve on them as a coherent depiction of the challenges we face. Brown's accomplishments in writing The Challenge of Man's Future, of course, was the construction of the sweeping scheme for understanding predicament. More remarkable was and is the combination of logic, thoroughness, clarity, and force with which he marshaled data and argumentation on every element of the problem and on their interconnections. It is a book, in short, that should have reshaped permanently the perceptions of all serious analysts. Well, here's a deluded guy who is not a serious analyst, but a idealist, and his idealism focuses on factors such as racism and discrimination. Wow, that's great. Great guy to hire, Mr. Obama. And he's written things about this very subject as recently as 2007. But let's take a look at something even more chilling, I think. Well, just as chilling, and that is a book he wrote in 1973 with a fellow, as Mr. Dellingpole references, as doom-mongers Ann Ehrlich and Paul Ehrlich, called Human Ecology, Problems and Solutions. And here's what they had to say. A massive campaign must be launched to restore a high-quality environment in North America and to develop the United States. Resources and energy must be diverted from frivolous and wasteful uses in overdeveloped countries to filling the genuine needs of underdeveloped countries. This effort must be largely political. Well, there you have it. Eugenics, politics, and de-developing the United States. Boy, that's the kind of guy I would want working for me in my administration. This is all the more reason to get rid of this president who is doing nothing but destroying our country. When you hire people like this, you have told me as a citizen, I want to destroy the nation as you know it. You can't hire somebody like this without having that intent. Or it's payback. It's payback for some sort of support that you've gotten in your election process without regard to the destruction that this guy is going to cause. So there you have it from James Dillingpole and Mr. Holdren, who is the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, a.k.a. Science Czar. We need to get rid of this administration. All right, let's see how we're doing on time. We're doing great on time. And what do we want to talk about next? Well, let's reiterate about the show tomorrow. We've got Franz Cabreau coming on at 4:15. I'll start the show at 4. Don't want to miss him. Stolen history and a few other topics that we'll talk about. Pretty much whatever Franz wants to talk about. I'll ask him a few questions, but I'm going to let him talk to you folks about what's going on, what's hot and important in Florida right now and in the country. And we will have a great conversation with him. Let's take another break here, and we'll be back up to wrap the show up.
National Veterans Homeless Support, or NVHS, was formed by veterans for the sole purpose of locating and assisting the more than 4,500 homeless veterans living in the parks, forests, and streets of Central Florida. Their mission is clearly defined, to eliminate homelessness among veterans in Central Florida, and they work very hard to accomplish this mission. They offer a very unique service to the community in that they are the only organization that goes out into the field, searching for the veterans, providing supplies where they find them, and working with other organizations to get them out of the woods and back into society. If you go to their website, it's located at nvhs.us, and you can also find them on Facebook. Their Veterans Resources link on their webpage is worth its weight in gold, so please go check out the website, and if you're able, make a donation. They do a very, very valuable service to the veterans of Central Florida, and we'd like to expand this and see it expand to the rest of the country.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.
All right, I'm back. Commander Tom Garcia here. This is the American Hour on the USA Talk Radio Network. You can find us going to usatalkradionetwork.com. You can also look up USA Talk Radio on Blog Talk and listen to us from there. All of the shows are stored, and you can stream them right off of the website, or you can even download them via iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at The American Hour, and if you go to Facebook, The American Hour Radio Show, do a search for that. And as I said earlier, we just gave away a 5,000-year leaf book and 12 constitutions to Teresa Acosta. And we'll be having another giveaway early in May. So go to that fan page, or I don't know if they're called fan pages anymore. They're always changing what they refer to these things. But go to the American Hour Radio Show page on Facebook. Join up there and keep tabs on what's going on, and you have a chance at winning next month's 5,000-year book. Also on Monday with Paul Skousen, because his father wrote the book. Listen in, and if you call in, you got a chance at winning one of a couple 5,000-year leaf books along with another dozen pocket constitutions, so don't miss that. All right, so we got Twitter covered, Facebook, and the website, and then if you want to get a hold of me, you can send a direct email to tom@tomgarcia.com. If you want to text me directly at 386-227-5616. And again, that's 386-227-5616. All right, well, it looks official that Obama has said he will veto a short-term bill. So what he's saying is you better come up with a long-term bill. Well, we haven't come up with a long-term bill, and tomorrow's Friday. And maybe they will. But so maybe he's exercising some good leadership here by putting pressure on the two sides to come to an agreement. But what if they don't? Then he really will shut it down. I think that's really what he wants. He wants the government shut down so he can demonize the Republicans. Let's think back to before the Republicans won this overwhelmingly this 2010 election and took power of the House. I seem to recall that when the Democrat Congress couldn't get anything done, it was always the Republicans' fault. But we know that's not true. The Republicans could have stayed home and not even shown up, and they still would have had enough majority to vote and pass whatever they wanted to pass in the House and the Senate and a president that would sign it. So it was the Republicans' fault when they really had no control or say over it. Now that the Republicans have a majority in the House, it's absolutely their fault. Oh, it's totally their fault, even though the Senate is a majority of Democrats and we've got a Democrat president. It's all the Republicans' fault. And it's all because the Republicans never want to come over to the side of the Democrats. It's not about compromise. It's about you've got to get on with us. That's why it's always their fault. I never see the Democrats compromise, ever. They're never compromised unless they absolutely have to. And so we talk about this, you know, let's become a little more civil and be able to talk and not be so partisan. If anybody's partisan, it's the Democrats. They're so absolutely partisan. The Republicans were hired by the people to cut spending and decrease debt. And I know a lot of people say, well, to create jobs. Well, yeah, we've got to cut the debt in order to create jobs. We've got to cut back on spending. Now, I keep seeing this, and I'm sure you've seen this in the news on any news station, including Fox. You've got people saying, listen, this might not be the time to cut federal spending because it's going to cost jobs. Since when did the federal government create jobs? The federal government, if we keep spending the way we're spending, we're just sucking money out of the private sector. The private sector creates jobs. By cutting federal spending, we will create jobs. This has nothing to do with taxes, cutting taxes, or anything else. Cutting spending. And it's not just spending money that we have. It's printing money that is very dangerous to this economy. So I think the goal is for the president to demonize the Republicans. We know that they're always blamed for everything, even when they have absolutely no power whatsoever. They're always blamed. All right. The other thing here is we've got a general, Army General Carter Ham, is saying that the U.S. may consider putting troops in Libya. He says ground forces wouldn't be ideal, but maybe a possible way to aid the rebels. Boy, isn't this how things get going? We start small, and then next thing, well, we need a little bit more, now I need a little bit more. Yeah, we could just go in there with overwhelming force and it'd all be over. But then guess what? Then are we responsible for the nation building afterwards? Yeah, because that's always the way it works. Interesting how Mr. Obama was so adamantly opposed to Iraq and Afghanistan and has, you know, said before he was elected that going in and trying to affect a civil war is a waste of time. And that's precisely what he's doing. Not to mention the fact that he really did not have any constitutional authority to go in there. And we've talked about that on a previous show. So I won't get into that right now. But we're going to wrap things up here tomorrow. Don't miss it. Franz Cabreau, 4 o'clock Eastern time, Stolen History, most influential conservative in Florida. You don't want to miss this. And if for some reason you can't make it, we'd love to have you call in and participate. But if you can't make it, you can go to the website and download it. Be sure and go to usatalkradionetwork.com. You can download it or stream it afterwards. Don't miss the show, and we'll be talking about some good stuff. And he's always got great ideas and insights into what's going on currently, as well as the history of our the conservative history of our nation. And I didn't mention it earlier, but Franz was a Democrat prior to reading up about the history of blacks in the U.S. and civil rights. And once he read up on the real history, the true history, he realized he was a Republican, and he definitely absolutely needed to switch to the Republican Party, which is what he's done. Republican Party's not perfect, a lot of flaws, and you've heard me call out the party on a lot of things, but it's the party we have that is the conservative party, and we're going to work to make it better. All right, thanks everybody for calling in or for listening in today, and big show tomorrow. Don't forget, be there, be square. I'm Tom Garcia, the American Hour on the USA Talk Radio Network. We'll be back tomorrow at 4 p.m. Friday. And we'll see you then.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.